Jem held up the bottom wire and motioned Dill under it. I followed and held up the wire for Jem. It was a tight squeeze for him. "Don't make a sound," he whispered. "Don't get in a row of collards, whatever you do. They'll wake the dead." With this thought in mind, I made perhaps one step per minute. I moved faster when I saw Jem far ahead, beckoning in the moonlight. We came to the gate that divided the garden from the backyard. Jem touched it. The gate squeaked. "Spit on it," whispered Dill. "You've got us in a box, Jem," I muttered. "We can't get out of here so easy." "Shh! Just spit on it, Scout." We spat ourselves dry, and Jem opened the gate slowly, lifting it aside and resting it on the fence. We were in the backyard. The back of the Radley house was less inviting than the front. A ramshackle porch ran the width of the house. There were two doors and two dark windows between the doors. Instead of a column, a rough 2x4 supported one end of the roof. An old Franklin stove sat in a corner of the porch. Above it, a hat-rack mirror caught the moon and shone eerily. The thing the time traveler held in his hand was a glittering metallic framework, scarcely larger than a small clock, and very delicately made. There was ivory in it and some transparent crystalline substance. And now, I must be explicit for this that follows, unless his explanation is to be accepted, is an absolutely unaccountable thing. He took one of the small octagonal tables that were scattered about the room and set it in front of the fire, with two legs on the hearth rug. On this table he placed the mechanism. Then he drew up a chair and sat down. The only other object on the table was a small shaded lamp, the bright light of which fell upon the model. There were also perhaps a dozen candles about, two in brass candlesticks upon the mantel, and several sconces, so that the room was brilliantly illuminated.